Glenna Wright Gallo, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here with you today.
Glenna, why don't we start off with a mood check? Because, typically I record with someone and then it's like weeks or months until it gets published. But this one is kind of a time sensitive situation. And I just wanted to get your sense, and I can talk about it too, of just the mood that you have regarding just the state of public education.
Yeah. Oh, there's my dog. That's funny. No, I locked mine downstairs so she wouldn't interrupt us. I'm very, very concerned. I'm somebody, I just recently spent 18 months at the Department of Ed in my previous role. But before that, I spent, almost 20 years at a state, at two different state educational agencies after working in classrooms and in local school districts. So I feel like, I really understand the system from all levels, value what the Federal Department of Ed brings to us. And so I'm quite concerned about, anything that has to do with, eradicating it, which I feel like is kind of pushing back against the premise and the value of public education in our country, right? And so for me, I take that very personally as someone who went through public ed, as a parent of two daughters who went through public ed, my future grandchildren. I value public ed so much that that I'm concerned about anything that I see as negative or seeks to degrade the system that we have. And let me be clear, I am not saying that public ed does not need to be improved, right? Like I have, in yeah. any job I've ever had, I have talked about needing to improve the system and ways that we can do that. So I am not saying that it's perfect and that we should maintain it status quo at all. But I think that when we start to tear down systems, as our reaction to needing to make improvements when we know what needs to be improved and choose not to do it, right? Like to me, that's an even bigger concern.
Yeah. And I want to get to the guidance about inclusive practices that was published right before the new administration, came on board. I just wanted to talk about that, but let's talk about that later. I want to set up this idea of, and I'll just do a quick story. Recently when, the executive order came down to pause federal funding, I was at home at my desk, preparing our communications, social media, all that stuff. And I was like, this seems big. This seems like really big. And not just for our organization, but for hundreds and thousands of organizations across the country. And that day was a particularly difficult day because mm-hmm. everyone was trying to figure out, what does this mean? What does this mean for our future? What does it mean for just education? What does it mean for IDEA funding? There was a lot of questions, and there still are a lot of questions, but I had, it was a difficult day. So, we had a family member at our house, that typically isn't, at our house. And so they asked me, I came downstairs and I'm like, man, that was a rough day, And they were like, well, what happened? And so I explained what happened, and my family member had some really interesting questions about they just had a lack of understanding of, well, why is that bad? Why is defunding the Department of Education bad? What do they actually do? How does that relate to your job? And so I think that there is just some lack of clarity and lack of understanding about why the Department of Ed is actually essential, why it exists, and specifically for our audience, what kind of impact the dismantling of the Department of Ed would have on special education. And so I'm wondering if we could do a little bit of a of just like some, you know, basic Ed Department 101 type of thing. You know, what role does the Department of Education play? How do they work together with IDEA?
Perfect. Yeah, happy to do so. And like I said, I've worked at all levels, so I think I have kind of a unique understanding. The state government and local governments manage the day-to-day operations of public education, while the federal government supports through funding kind of national programs to look at consistency across states and policy recommendations. You hear a lot about state and local control of education, and we don't want the feds deciding standards. And I think that's very much like a misunderstood concept, because the states control curriculum standards. The states control teacher certification, whereas the feds come in and offer financial assistance through congressionally appropriated funding. You know, so the federal government focuses on providing that supplementary support and coordination, such as services to vulnerable populations like children with disabilities. I also think that people forget that state governments, you know, establish academic standards. They determine graduation requirements. They fund schools through local tax and state tax mechanisms. They develop the educational policies for their schools and implement assessment systems to evaluate school performance and maintain quality of education. Now, a lot of times people think, well, why does it matter? Why do we need some consistency across states? And when we think about students who move from state to state, we want to make sure that they have, you know, similar educational opportunities through public ed from state to state. Like when we think about like our military connected children, right, who are moving from state to state pretty frequently because of reassignments, that's an area that really highlights the need for some level of consistency. But again, those day-to-day decisions, those major policy decisions happen at the state and local levels. Now, the thing that the federal government does, though, in addition to allocating those congressionally appropriated funds, is it provides an opportunity to monitor, right? So IDEA is a federal law that specifies the requirements for how special ed has to be delivered and the procedural safeguards or the parents' rights that are included within that. The states and districts are responsible for meeting those requirements and develop their own rules and policies to do so, but the federal government through Ed monitors the implementation. So make sure that they're meeting those requirements. And when they're not, it provides technical assistance and support and resources to help them improve and to help them get there. So all of that, I think, kind of shows that dual system where the federal government provides kind of that oversight area, helps support consistency and ensures adequate implementation of IDEA, but isn't identifying the specific actions that happen within each state. I mean, the other thing that the federal government does is it uses those funds that have been allocated by Congress to address areas of need that happen across the nation. So like one thing that comes up that's like top of mind that we've done a lot of work on recently is around the critical shortage of special ed personnel and providers. And so federal funds and federal action has been taken to increase and to really improve and expand preparation programs to bring in people who can be trained to provide those services. if that went away, we would see that shortage even, you know, grow. We know that funds are allocated to states, to districts, to nonprofits for evidence-based research and innovative ideas, technical assistance centers, and then parent training and information centers to help parents. So those are all kind of a couple of things that the department does, but it doesn't usurp the role and the responsibility of states. And that's where people seem to get really confused with this, is they think that the feds are setting all of those requirements and are dictating things to the state, whereas that dictation is only around the legal requirements.
What would happen if all of those functions of the Department of Ed, specifically or ED. I just recently realized that I was giving the acronym incorrectly. It's not DOE, it's ED. So I'm just
right. Otherwise, it's Department of Energy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But I know. I just recently learned that when I went there.
So, what practically would happen though if those functions moved somewhere else? Because I think the argument for those who are pro, well, let's get rid of the Department of Education, is, well, that all of that stuff can still happen. It just can happen underneath another umbrella. Like, what would be gained or lost if that actually happened?
Yeah. So I've thought about that a lot. You know, I talked about kind of the role of the Federal Department of Education. And so let's think about, like, if we were to kind of piecemeal it out into different departments, right? The Department of Labor, the Department of Health and Human Services, we're starting to fragmentize those responsibilities that are education in nature and putting them out over separate systems. And when we think about all of the work that's been done around implementation of IDEA, which is turning 50 this year, right? Mm-hmm. And when we had the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, it included additional protections for children with disabilities. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act that OCR, you know, had some responsibility responsibility to enforce as well. And then the title program. So we have all of these different laws that are the oversight is the responsibility of the department. And if we start piecemealing those out, we're going to see kind of fragmentation of the responsibilities. And so those laws have all served to say, you know, children with disabilities and other vulnerable populations are entitled to the same educational opportunities that all students are entitled to in the United States. And so when we start to piecemeal those out and start saying, okay, well, this part should be labor and this part should be health, we're going to start seeing a denigration of that integration. We're going to see a separation from general education standards. You know, special ed is currently integrated within the general ed framework to ensure that children with disabilities receive that same quality of education. So moving oversight to a different department could result in a disconnect from those general ed standards, resulting in inconsistent educational experiences for students with disabilities. We also could see a creation of a siloed system. Right? It's really hard to create large systems that are integrated when you put them across different departments. And that's something that we're all aware of, right? The first thing that people tend to want to do when they take a new role or a new leadership role is to reorganize. And evidence and research has shown that that's not as effective as other actions that you could take. So one of the goals of modern education is to create this inclusive environment where all students, regardless of their abilities, can learn together. So moving special education oversight out of ed could lead to a more siloed system where we treat special ed as that separate entity. This could reverse progress made towards inclusive education and hinder social and academic progress and integration of children with disabilities. right? And when we think about the fact that ID...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Gay, like I said, is turning 50. Like, this could set us back to the beginning where we were fighting for access of children with disabilities into schools. And so moving it outside of ed, it could be sending that message that that's okay, that they're not entitled to education. Loss of coordinated support. So I talked about separation from general standards. It could be creation of a siloed system, but now we don't have one entity that's pulling all of that together. You referenced the inclusive practices guidance that came out under the Biden-Harris administration in January of 2025. The big point of that was not just that we were looking at evidence-based practices that supported children with disabilities, but it pointed out that the requirements under IDEA and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act were coordinated, and it showed coordination between OSERS, the Office of Special Education Programs, and the Office of Elementary and Secondary Ed, which we have not seen historically a lot of. That was major steps of progress, coordinating that guidance, coordinating those efforts moving forward. That could lead to gaps, right, in services and support. We could see an impact on policy and funding. Ed plays a crucial role in implementing policies and providing funding for special ed programs. Those funds are determined and appropriated from Congress and are allocated out for specific activities, and that was then implemented by Ed. And I think that is really a fascinating process. And I was just having a conversation with my father about that this morning, about when we disseminate funds that have been appropriated by Congress, there's a very specific process that has to be followed that involves public notification of the Federal Register of those funding opportunities, the priorities that they're going to be used for that were congressionally approved. It gives the public an opportunity to provide input. We take that input and then go back and examine what we said we were going to do and make changes generally based on that input. Then we put it out for anyone to apply. And then we bring in impartial experts to review the applications and recommend who gets funded, right? So it's a very specific process with lots of oversight and public notification and involvement. And when we start moving that around or saying that that process doesn't matter, when we have already said the funds can be used and Congress put them out for that purpose, like, that sets a very interruptive precedence that would have long-term impact on policy and funding. It could reduce the effectiveness of special ed programs and services by interrupting the work that has already been agreed upon and identified. And then, you know, we talked about the inclusive practices, so I know we'll get into that more. But I also think that it's really important that when we think about the education of children with disabilities, to recognize that in the United States, one in four adults has a disability. And I think that statistic, when we talk about the fact that that's 25% of the U.S. adult population, really highlights that significant impact that dismantling the department could have on a large portion of the population. Like, removal of federal oversight and support could lead to, like I said, a fragmented and less effective education system that could ultimately have a negative impact on the quality of life and opportunities for millions of people with disabilities. Ensuring that everyone has the necessary support and resources for public education is key to our, you know, society.
Okay, let's talk about oversight, because I think, again, there's just a misunderstanding of, you know, what the functions of the Department of Education, of how it relates to IDEA oversight. And so help our listeners understand what kind of oversight and accountability, if that's the right word, that the federal government has on states. And I'll give you kind of just a general example. There's reports every year that talk about compliance, right? Mm-hmm. What states are in compliance of the federal law of IDEA? And a number of states are out of compliance, like all the time. All the time. And so if you have states that are out of compliance all the time, then what's, you know, someone could say, well, what's the point? Like, what's the point of having the oversight that we currently have? Because it seems like it's not making a difference. So help us understand that. Help us understand what the current functions of oversight of the states and IDEA looks like.
Definitely. So, I'm going to say one of the biggest ones that we hear about the most with the oversight would be monitoring. So where the department goes in and monitors the special ed programs of states, and they monitor both types of programs. So the Part C, which is the early intervention for our youngest children, those who are birth through two, and then the Part B programs, which are ages 3 through 21. And so they go in and they look at what are the legal requirements under IDEA. Are states following those? And if not, what is needed to get them into compliance with that? Now, you know, it's not just like a check sheet. It's going in, they're looking at records, they're looking at budgets, they're talking to families, they're talking to local school districts, they're looking at data showing what's happening in the state. And frequently they identify something that was missed or was misunderstood. When you think about, right, like when you think about the rapid changes that is going on, we have new rules that go into place, we have new laws that go into place, we have judicial decisions, we have executive orders, right? All of that kind of changes the landscape of what's required in small ways, mostly small ways, sometimes large ways. And so when we also think about the fact that in education, we have these critical shortages and we have rapid turnover of staff, there's a lot of times a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, not being aware that something has changed, not being aware that the way they're doing something or have historically done something is not in alignment with the requirements. All of those pieces come into play. It's also an opportunity to really talk about areas where things could be improved. So it's not just about compliance with the law. It's how do we get better using the resources that has been funded by Congress, right, around research. So that monitoring piece is key. It comes with it a requirement that if you're out of compliance, you have to fix it quickly, right? And it's generally within 1 year, as soon as possible, but within 1 year. And the piece that people a lot of times don't know about is the fact that it's not just the system or the policy that they have to fix. They actually have to fix it for the children. So if it impacted a child with a disability, they have to fix it for them as well. And I think that's key when we really think about this. This isn't just about like putting things out into like the ether, like they broke a law, now they have to follow it. It's about going back and making these children whole and fixing it for their education. The other big oversight is that states have to do an annual report, a state performance plan, SPP, or annual performance report around 18 indicators, I think it is now. The indicators are a mix of compliance indicators and results or outcomes indicators. So it looks not only at did they follow IDEA, but are things getting better? Are children having improved outcomes? And it really requires states to focus on data as well as input from their families and data around dispute resolution. So it's not just, did you follow the law and are students learning? It's, what does your community think about what you're doing? Do they feel like the education system is geared towards getting and using their input to making it better? When there's a dispute, do they come to the table and work with you to resolve it, right? Those types of things. So that's the second piece. The third piece is what we call customer service. And it's that every state has people assigned to them in the department who help them address issues. So they're taking calls from concerned constituents in the state. They're answering questions from the state and local education agencies or policymakers. They're sharing information and resources. We have millions of dollars that go out to technical assistance centers to help improve outcomes, to improve compliance, to work on dispute resolution, to train parents, and they're helping people access and identify those resources. So that's, I think that's like the quick, easy part of the official kind of formal monitoring system. Now, the part that is also there is that people write into the department. So I would get emails, I would get calls from family members, from states, from legislatures saying, this is what's going on. What can you tell us about the resources that are out there? How can we change this? And there are things that we know about that we could provide information. You know, I had a parent who was very concerned about the way dispute resolution was implemented in their state. We were able to have conversations about, here's what IDEA allows. Here's what's happening in your state. It's not contrary to IDEA. But if you disagree with this, here are your options, right? Go to your congressional delegation. Have these conversations. So it really provides information in a way that allows people to get more involved in their federal government and their local government by providing those resources.
And there's a level of expertise that is available for those things to happen. And so yes. I'm imagining that with the dissolvement of the education department, it's very possible you're not going to have that kind of expertise where families will be able to actually reach out and get some answers. I'm thinking about even, you know, Dear Colleague letters, any sort of guidance to states on how to improve special education services, that would be largely, you know, quote unquote, given back to the states. And in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinions, the states aren't, they don't do that great of a job monitoring themselves.
So I'm not going to go down that road. As a former state person, as someone who designed a state monitoring, I'm going to say this, right? Uh-huh. It's super easy when you're really close to something, when you feel very passionate about it, to think that what you're doing is the right thing and to kind of go down, you know, to get blinders on and say, this is what needs to happen. And we all need to be held accountable. We all need to have, you know, public input and people saying, what about this? Did you think about this? Right. And so having those different levels of systems and oversight create that ability to, you know, that continuous improvement ability of what are we doing? Is it the right thing? Do we need to course correct? Now that happens at every level, right? And it's kind of about being critical thought partners in addition to the monitoring and that general level of oversight. But again, with the rapid change, like we are seeing people at state educational agencies turn over rapidly. When I was a state director of special ed, I was one for 7 years in Utah, 5 years in Washington. I was one of the longest standing state directors of special ed at that time because they were losing them so rapidly. That isn't the way it was prior to when I became a state director. People would go into those jobs and stay there a long time. Now you're seeing people 1 to 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you see staff turn over that rapidly, you're losing that historical knowledge, right, of someone understanding why decisions have been made, what went into them, when they might need to be revisited. When we think about the team at OSEP, and the team at OSERS, I can tell you that the majority of them are like able to retire within the next 5 or so years. So if we see a mass exodus, we are going to see a tremendous loss of knowledge and historical knowledge.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
These are people who have been committed to serving on behalf of children with disabilities for decades, who understand the law, who understand that despite the administration, the law remains, and who speak up on behalf of the populations that they serve. These are not people who are just, you know, blindly following whatever someone tells them to do. They are saying, here's why this decision was made. Here's the legal context. Here's the judicial decisions that have gone into this. And they're supporting the work, you know, and the decisions made by the top leaders, but they're informing them so that they can make the best decisions possible. If we lose that, I mean, I don't know how we're going to continue to provide and improve the process. That loss of historical knowledge is going to be detrimental to the children that we say we're here to serve.
Right, right.
And again, I'm just going to say this again. I'm not saying it's perfect. And anyone who's ever worked with me knows that I did not say it's perfect. Like I'm the first one to be like, how can we make this better? Did we do it the best way?
I think that's a great point. And you know, we just had a webinar with a professor from Ohio University, a journalist from The Independent, and then we had our CEO, Carolyn Teaglin, and I. We were discussing, discussing changes and possible impact. And I think that one of the things that we, for people who are defending public education, one of the messages that we need to get across is that you know, we may be defending the institution of mm-hmm. public education, but that doesn't mean that we are defending the status quo,
right?
You know, we want to keep the institution, we want to reform the institution to make it work better for everyone, but that doesn't mean we don't want things to change. You know,
yeah. And I think people see it as an either or, right?
Right, right.
And so they're like, it's not working. Well, there are aspects of it that are not working. That is true. There are also aspects that are working.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to discuss impact, and I want to discuss the impact that the current administration is having, the potential impact that it will have on the priority of really being aggressively against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Mm-hmm. And I want to be very clear here, because I think, you know, if you kind of pay attention to the news and what's happening, you see corporate America scaling back from DEI. You see certain organizations, you know, scrubbing websites, you know, with language and stuff like that. You know, the executive order and what the current administration has the quote unquote power to do, we're really just talking about things that are funded by federal money. And so that would include, you know, parts of public education, and, you know, federal pass-through dollars that get sent to states, and then the states decide on, you know, how they are going to use that money for grants or whatever. And so I think there's some confusion with what this actually means, this aggressive rooting out of DEI initiatives, and then also this idea of rooting out radical indoctrination. And if you want to read the executive order, you can. It's on the, you know, it's on the White House website and Education Department as their priorities. And so that's kind of the bigger picture. What I want to do and ask you, if you have any insight about the potential impact that all of this attention that's being paid to diversity, equity, and inclusion, how that might impact what is currently happening in the programming of serving learners with disabilities. Because, you know, our organization, MCIE, the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, we have inclusion in the name mm-hmm. of our organization. We are focused on the inclusion of learners with disabilities, but also the inclusion of all students, of all learners. And the organizations that we know that are doing very similar work, they are also not just focused on learners with disabilities. There's a lot of concern about how this might impact everyone doing the work of inclusion. So what are kind of your initial thoughts about that?
Well, Tim, I have so many. so, you know, I'm going to say this. When we talk about like scaling back, right? Like, we're really talking about elimination. So I think back, like, okay, so we're saying that we're against diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so then I think, okay, what does that mean? Like, if we're against diversity, that means we're for segregation. If we're against equity, we're for inequity. And if we're against inclusion, we're for exclusion, right? Like that doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense to me with the morals that I feel as a human being. It doesn't make sense to me with our constitution. It doesn't make sense to me with our laws for public education and IDEA. And then, you know, it becomes even more personal to me as a person with a disability and as a female. Like, what does that mean, that I am less qualified by virtue of my birth? Right? Does that mean that because I have a hearing impairment, that I couldn't possibly be qualified for the jobs that I've had, and that I've only gotten them, you know, because of this? Like, to me, like, that's so belittling for so many Americans. And so, you know, when I think about that, that is not the United States that I want to live in. I think it's scary to me that when we start weaponizing and we're eradicating DEI, we're weaponizing terms, that it's not about, the conversation isn't about maintaining rights or improving education and learning. The conversation is about eliminating and removing. And as a parent and as an educator, that really scares me. You know, when I think about inclusion and I think about a lot of times like inclusive practices, what is it that needs to be put in place that allows everybody access and to learn and to, you know, make progress? And so when I think about exclusionary practices, that's going to lead to increased discrimination and reduced opportunities. And luckily for us, you know, special education and disability advocates, this has been, you know, historically a grassroots opportunity where they have said the status quo is not okay. Our children not only deserve access, they deserve the same opportunities. Our history has demonstrated a need for federal oversight to address those inequities. And that federal involvement has been crucial in making sure that children with disabilities receive the support and the resources that they need to be successful. And so when we start removing things and weaponizing terms, we see, I think, an immediate negative impact. Like, I'm going to say the first one I've seen is we have seen reduced use and access to ASL interpreters. In our news media, we're not seeing when the White House, you know, is releasing information. We don't see that it goes out in a ways that is accessible by all of the population. When we're using only certain sites, such as X, to disseminate information, right? We're excluding people. So, you know, when we say we're going to eliminate things and then we start to take concrete actions to remove access to certain groups of people who we have, I don't know, deemed unworthy of accessing the information, that's how it feels as a person with a disability, that someone has made that choice for me. That is incredibly problematic. I don't know. How do you feel about it? This is all about me, and I know you're interviewing me, but I'm curious, Tim.
A couple of years ago, when there was a lot of talk around critical race theory and anti critical race theory movement. I mean, and it just, if you like think back, when the school board meetings were, you know, people were like packed into school board meetings and they were demanding the school board, you know, that they need to do something about this. Quote unquote anti-racist teachings, critical race theory indoctrination and everything like that. I live in Georgia. So I work for MCIE, which is in Maryland, but I work remotely from the Atlanta metro area in Georgia. And so I saw it very, I was very close to the, you know, to school boards that a lot of these things were happening. And so, I tell this story. This was a couple of years ago. I did this podcast episode about, what inclusionists need to know about the CRT, anti-CRT movement. And, there was a principal that lived in Maryland, who was moving down to Georgia. And, I think to get closer to family, and she took a position in a local school district as the, diversity, equity, and inclusion director. And because of all of this, attention paid to CRT, the community, became enraged that this district hired a person for this position. And so at a school board meeting, they just were like, we can't do this. This is awful. You know, this person is going to, you know, bring in all of this critical race theory, which is, you know, ridiculous, you know, but for lots of different reasons. But the principal that was going to move down ended up resigning from the position before she even started because of this backlash. Mm-hmm. And my point was, I'm like, this is a person that was not only well qualified for that job, but her mindset and her heart were in, like, this is the kind of person you wanted to be in that position. Somebody who was thinking about all learners with, you know, extensive support needs, learners with, you know, learning disabilities, all kinds of learners, and how they could feel welcomed and create inclusive schools. This is the exact person that we want as a nonprofit who is focusing on inclusive schools. This is the exact person you want to work in a district. Like, you want this person, right? But because of all of this attention, now this person took another career path, is doing something else now, mm-hmm. and not in this role. And so my kind of thinking was like, all of this is really going to create some ripple effects for people who we want in schools to develop inclusive schools, welcoming schools for all learners. And they're just, you know, not gonna, they're like, forget it. No, I'm not gonna be in public education, you know?
This is definitely, you know, we already have shortages. And so, you know, we have long-term subs in thousands of classrooms across the United States because we don't have available staff who have been trained, who want to go into this career.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And so, you know, we will see all of these things impacting. So, and then when we don't have trained staff in classrooms, what's the long-term impact on a child, right? And when we know that there are critical stages of learning and we don't have, you know, providers available, you know, all of those things will have a lifetime impact on our population.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, because we're arguing about things that may not be the right things to argue. Like,
yeah,
we all believe children should learn. We all believe, right, in education. Public education is a large premise, you know. I'm not going to say we all believe in public education because I think we know that that's not true. But,
right. Yeah.
But we do believe in education. And so how is it that we can meet on the things that we agree on and make improvements in the areas that need to be improved in without dismantling the entire system? Because our children can't afford for us. They can't afford for us to wait. I mean, when I talk to leaders, that's a conversation I have. Like, do your actions reflect your values? If you say you're improving and that improvements are needed, are you making those changes? If you have the research showing you that something is more effective than something that you're doing, are you switching? Like, it's not about maintaining status quo because it's comfortable. It's about doing what's best for the children that we serve. And that's why we went into this field, right? That's why you and I are here, is because we care about this.
Right. Yeah. We care about, you know, providing a good public education system for all mm-hmm. learners. Something
and I'm
else.
Gonna say every parent cares, right? Every parent cares about their children.
There's so many people that benefit, you know, from a robust and good public education system. You know, no matter where you live in the United States. Something that just popped into my head when you were talking about change, because something that we think about a lot at MCIE is systems change. Mm-hmm. And so if you're listening and you're going, well, where are you going with this, Tim? Like, there's this whole science around implementation. There's this like this whole, all this research and science about how you change systems, right? Mm-hmm. And what's really, it's not necessarily funny, but it is interesting to think about. You know, when, you know, new administrations come and they make changes, that is expected. But when you make changes so fast and without any input from anybody, from the mm-hmm. stakeholders, it causes chaos and confusion. Just a lot, there's a lot of trauma going on, everywhere, not only in education, but just across the whole spectrum. When you look at the federal government, and so I've been reflecting and going, like, we actually know how to change systems. There's plenty of research and books and knowledge out there. So if somebody was really concerned about changing a system effectively, they have the resources to do it. So that makes me feel like maybe they don't want to change the system. Maybe they just want to break the system. And that may or may not make it into this podcast because it is a little bit inflammatory. So right. I'm just going to make a mental note of that. But I think that any person that is observing what's going on right now, can see that things are breaking as opposed to changing. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna. I'm going to say that I think that sometimes we can be very arrogant and we think that we know the right thing to do and that we don't need to pay attention to what others have said, right? Because in my experience, this happened. And so therefore this must be the experience of everyone. And so, you know, this may not make it into the podcast either, but a conversation that I have with my husband, is he'll say, well, if just this happened, if they would just do this about a situation, and I'd say, really, is that it? Really? You think nobody was like, let's just do that. And if it would fix the system, right, they're choosing to not do it. And it's because systems are so complex, right? Mm. But that doesn't mean we don't do things, right? And right. I am frequently the first one to say, we know what works. Right. One of the things that I talk about publicly all of the time is that we have research that shows that children who are the most vulnerable need educators with the most content experts. And that is not what happens in special ed in the majority of systems. Right. Mm-hmm. And so by saying that, I am not denigrating the work done by para educators or something, but I am saying that the research hasn't shown that they need teachers with the most content expertise. And yet we do not make funding decisions. We do not make staffing decisions that is in alignment with that research. Right. And so I think that it's a combination of, I don't know the research. I don't have time to look at the research. I don't have time to think about what the research says. I'm worried about not having the funding that I need to implement the research, or people are against what I'm trying to do. And so there's all of those opposing forces that are coming in that we have to push back against. But pushing back against is the right work, not just saying, I don't believe in any of this, so I'm just going to do whatever I want to do, right?
Right.
and destroy the system. Like, yeah, me, yeah. That's like temper tantruming.
Yeah. I think that is a very, nonpartisan idea. This idea that you have the ability to push back against something that you disagree with. I think that is what makes our country great, because we have the freedom to push back against those things. So,
We have the structure, we have the checks and balances in place with the executive system, the judicial system, and and Congress, the legislative system. And so, all of those things, like, there are layers that were put into place to support everyone and to make sure that we had those checks and balances. And so, why are we abandoning those?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Let's get a little wonky. Is that okay? Funding?
Wonky.
Because I think there's also some misunderstanding about what it means when we talk about funding for IDEA. So there are formula grants, and then there are discretionary grants. Is that right?
That is right.
Funding. Sorry. It's funding, all the same thing. Sorry. Yeah. So help me understand, help our listeners understand, when we're talking about federal money that goes to the states for IDEA, what's the difference between formula and discretionary? And then we can kind of get into what each of those things do.
Perfect. So, yes. So, with the IDEA allocation that comes from Congress, we see formula, we see discretionary. And so the formula is based on in statute in IDEA, it talks about how to calculate the amount of IDEA funding that goes directly to states. And it's a mixture of data, mostly historical data, like really old data. I'm not going to lie, right? Like, it's back there a bit. One of the things when I talk to communities, that I always want to highlight is that with those formula grants, states actually have to apply for those annually. They have to make assurances that they're meeting certain requirements, and they have to publicly post and hold hearings about their budget, how they're going to use those funds. So, like, a set amount goes to the state. The state then has to take a set amount of that and flow it directly to districts for special ed services. And then they have some that they can use for what we would call discretionary funds, but the law actually calls them state level activities. And they have some required state level activities like monitoring and dispute resolution that they have to do. And then they have allowable state level activities, which would be, paperwork reduction, technical assistance, training of staff, transition, school to post-school transition activities, things that they do for that. So they have to create their budget and how they're going to spend those funds, and they have to post it publicly, and they have to use public hearings. They have to have at least two before they submit their budget to the department for approval. Now, I bring this up because state director, 12 years across two states, held lots and lots of hearings. I can tell you that less than 10 people ever came to or provided input in a hearing. In a state. Right. Tremendous missed opportunities. So I always think about that. Like, I think about the fact that we publicly post things, we ask for input, and people don't engage. And there's two reasons why. Well, there's multiple reasons, but I'm just for simplistic sake going to say either they don't know or they don't know how to engage, right? So, so that's a lot of conversation that I have with people a lot of times is it's not just about inviting people to the meeting. It's about making sure that they can participate, that they have the information, they have that the meeting is set up to allow them and to encourage and to support participation. So that's the formula side. I got super wonky, sorry. The discretionary side of the federal government then has to be spent in specific ways, and the ways are dictated during the congressional appropriations. So for the IDEA funds, you'll see things that are specific around training of personnel. You'll see things that are specific around technology and the use of technology, the use of data. And then there can be some that are administratively driven. But all of those have to be spent on very specific line items. And I bring this up because it was incredibly frustrating to me that sometimes it would make sense to braid some of those line items together. And it's incredibly difficult to do because of the way the funds are allocated. Mm. So it's something that someone would be like, well, if you would just do this, right? And you can't just do that. But I referenced this earlier. When those funds are allocated, they come with directions from Congress. That's when you have to put out the notice. It goes to the public register. It has to be posted for so many days. You have to allow public comment. Then you have to respond to the public comment. And then you make changes based on the public comment. And public comment does change things. I can tell you as someone who has done the work, I have seen things change, be adjusted, be removed, not move forward, or pass based all on that public comment. And so those discretionary grants go to support things that are really critical to education. Research around disability needs, disability education. And we've seen, right, there is a massive amount of research about what evidence-based instructional practices are, what we know about learning, what we know about assistive technology, what we know about AI, all of those things, like that is based on research. Training of staff. So training of our teachers, our speech pathologists, our OTs, our PTs, our school psychs, our school counselors, our voc rehab specialists when we start looking at employment, our early intervention providers, all of that goes into making sure that people continue to go into the field, continue to be trained, and then trying to retain them so that we have the long-term impact of that. Those are kind of the big things. With technology, we've seen closed caption media, instructional technology get funded. I don't know if you've seen the Monarch that's come out of the American Printing House for the Blind, but it's a multi-line braille reader that is revolutionizing how people who are blind can access instructional materials.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
In real time, Bookshare, making sure that, materials are accessible. There are so many projects that people use on a day-to-day basis that they don't realize were developed under those discretionary funds.
Right. Yeah. Isn't the Describe Caption and Media program also part of that? Yeah.
Yes.
We're friends.
I mean, I could just like run down.
Yeah. There's so many. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I just
let's talk about like early childhood, right? The
yes,
fact that Part C of the IDEA is not an entitlement, and so like the school age population, you know, we have, you know, for kindergarten through 12th grade, we have, you know, entitlement to services, where we don't have that same entitlement for our preschool or our early intervention. States don't all designate that as a priority. They don't fund it to the same levels. And so this kind of provides those opportunities to our youngest learners in states that have not elected to fund those programs.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that was a great overview. Thank you. You brought up the lack of participation in, you know, the hearings and everything. I was talking with somebody from, it was somebody in early childhood at Department of Ed. This was a while ago. I don't remember who I was talking to, but the general sense was that I have always felt like Department of Ed it's like a communication. It's like comms. It's all about comms. Like if there isn't a significant investment in communication channels, then how will people know? Right. And you really see it with the school districts who have really robust communications. And I feel like my local school district does a really good job with communications. But that is like where it is. So if even at the State Department, it's really difficult, the infrastructure, right? And communications is expensive. It's really expensive. You know, if you want to even call it marketing, it's expensive, right? Especially when you just don't have, you know, you don't put it in the budget, or you don't, it's not a priority, you know? So that's just something that I've always thought. And yeah, I don't know if that makes
any sense.
I think
about it slightly different, right? Like, I think there's so much information available to us that there's like this information overload. And then we don't always have the time to think through like the long-term impact or why something may matter to us unless it's flagged for us, right? So, I mean, I was thinking about that, like just in reading the news today. And somebody had posted that like Google searches of certain topics like went through the roof and are like outnumbering, like political Google searches are outnumbering searches about the Super Bowl, right? And so, like when you think about that, right, it's because something has caught their attention and they're like, oh, wait, I need to know more about this. And so, how is it that we get this information that's necessary, that's impactful to people in a way that lets them know it's important to them, that lets them know the long-term impact without steering them towards a decision, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we provide the information in a neutral manner that allows them to recognize the impact to them? And I do worry about that. I worry that the slant, right, that is given to everything now removes some of that opportunity for us to process it, right? And the neutrality of information.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd say that
as a special ed person and not as a communications major.
Well, I am an accidental communications person. So, I agree. I want to wrap up our conversation. I think we've gotten a lot of really good information. I would like to know if you see any reason for hope. And then, so hope and then some practical steps that educators can do, that they feel like they need to do something. So Yeah, right. I don't know if you have any ideas. So do you have any reason for hope? Let's start there.
You know what? I do. I'm incredibly worried. I'm watching things. I'm exercising, you know, my rights as a citizen to provide input. But I will say this, like education and services to children with disabilities has historically been a bipartisan issue. I also know in everything that I'm reading that the majority of Americans oppose plans to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education and recognize that every child deserves and has rights to public education and, if eligible, to special ed services. I also know that families and advocates and grassroots organizations have played and will continue to play a crucial role in addressing the dismantling and elimination of protections for people with disabilities. They have been successful historically in adding these protections and identifying gaps in services and advocating for them and getting them. For me, the hope is in our public and collective voice and speaking out for what we know is right and what we know is just. I think about this. You know, I started off as a special educator, and I always say, like, once a special ed teacher, always a special ed teacher. But part of the professional standards around special ed teachers are that we have to have, uphold professional principles and advocate on behalf of the children we serve. And I think that, as a profession, this is even more meaningful now, but knowing that we are all touched, that we all love and know someone who has a disability, remember 1 in 4. Right? Like, this is even more important for us to speak out. And we've made it so easy to speak out with technology. Like, the fact that you can easily look up who your representatives are, you can easily contact them, whether it's by phone, by mail, by email, you can go in person, right? There's all of these things. But I would say now is not the time to be silent. I'm the parent of two young adults, and one of the things that I've been kind of pondering about this last week or two is the outcry that I saw when TikTok went away. Mm-hmm. And I think, people came out of the woodworks to voice their displeasure with the fact that this app went down for 12 hours or something. Are we going to do the same thing to protect public education? Like, what is more important to us? And so, yes, I'm very hopeful, and I'm also very realistic that this is not the time to stand by and think somebody else will do it. This is the time where we have to say, this is what matters to us. It's bipartisan. This is not about political affiliation. This is about what I want for my children, my grandchildren, for what I want for my communities. And education has always been under state and local control. That is not changing. But we can't say that they are the end all be all. We have to have some safeguards in place. We have to say there is more oversight, there is more coordination, because when we didn't have that, we had gaps in services.
Absolutely. Any practical steps for people who want to do something, who don't want to stay silent?
You know what? I am contacting my elected representatives, those at the congressional level, and I am voicing what I believe in, what I am asking them to do. I am thanking them when they do something that I agree upon. I am telling them when I disagree. I think this is what it comes down to. And having conversations with our friends and our families and our neighbors about why things are important. You know, a lot of times we do not want to go into those conversations because we feel ill-equipped or we feel uncomfortable. yeah, this is not a time where we can feel ill-equipped or comfortable. We need to look, we need to research, we need to have those conversations. You know, I've been reading comments of what people are saying with their arguments either way. I want to see both sides of the aisle. I want to see why people disagree, why they agree, what they're thinking. I want to hear about the impact and what public education has done for them. And I also want to remember that just because something was my experience, that does not mean it's the experience of everyone else, right? That we all have, like when you think about it, like so many of us have lived experiences with public education. And I have to remember that what happened to me is not what happened to someone else always, but that doesn't discount either of our experiences. Again, we're not perfect. We have improvements to make. But why are we only talking about the gaps? Why are we not also talking about the successes? And how do we leverage those successes? You know, I want to know that people who are listening to others, who are asking those hard questions, who are looking at the data and who are looking at the research are the ones making this decision. And I think we demand that.
Thank you for that. And I am hopeful, as much as I know that this is a, these are, you know, uncertain times. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cliche at this point, but, you know, that, people are speaking up, people are engaged. And so, I am hopeful about that. Let's end on a fun note. How about that? Okay. So I've got this segment called a mystery question. I have a stack of cards and I will pick one and then you and I will answer it together. Okay. Does that sound fun? Maybe.
I don't know that I would use the word fun, but yes, I'm in, Tim.
It's fun for me. All right, here we go. This is kind of a serious one, but let's just go with it. What is the main thing that influences your decisions? Now, you can take it seriously or not. Let's see if I can get it. What is the main thing that influences your decisions? However you want to go. Do you have something?
So I would say for me, I have a really strong sense of justice. Like what is right and wrong? And that really plays into my decisions. I will take it back to how does this impact a child? And people hear me say that all the time. Like, this isn't about, you know, my feelings being hurt. This isn't about this. This is about the life of a child. And so I'm going to say that sense of justice for me is huge, not to be eclipsed by data. Right. I think like the whole "in God we trust, all others must show" data for me is huge.
I'm glad you went there. I'm going to go a little bit of a different route. So, okay. I've really been realizing the power of storytelling, and storytelling being, I mean, stories is in a sense data, right? So, it's just a different kind of data.
Kind of anecdotal, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so, and I mean, we're on a podcast and I do listen to podcasts a lot. I'm a podcaster who listens to podcasts. Right. And I love narrative podcasts. Narrative podcasts are my favorite. So I think about the things that have really changed my mind about certain things, and it almost always always comes down to a story. So because I listened to someone tell their story, I feel differently about something, a topic, and I've changed the way that I've interacted or have made a decision about something. Mm-hmm. So when I think about what really influences me, I think storytelling influences me. I didn't know what I was going to say until you said what you said. So thank you for going first. all right.
What's awesome. I don't want to answer a second question, but I just want to know, like, what other kinds of questions are in your deck of questions?
So the most recent one that I can think of was like, what's a book that everyone, that you feel like everyone needs to read?
Okay.
Or like, what was one that was really silly? What's something that you are not afraid of that most people are? Those kinds of things.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we could do a bonus question.
No. I'm good. I just was curious. I was just curious.
Eventually I'm going to run out of questions. And then, I have a 12-year-old and I told her that she can create some cards.
I have to tell you, if you said I have a mystery question and my 12-year-old created this, I would have been like, tell me more.
Yes. Well, you'll have to come back on.
Okay. Anytime. Okay. You have made this relatively painless, and I hope it was helpful to you and your listeners.
This has been so helpful, and I really, really appreciate the time, especially because this was a little bit longer than I usually go. Okay. Glenna Wright Gallo, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. We really appreciate your time, your thoughts, and your energy. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been very enjoyable. I appreciate it.